This is the Drone Zone on EAA Radio, and we're still talking with Lily Johnson, Sean Elliott, and Tom Charpentier.
We might, if Sean's okay, we might let these guys get a word in edgewise. I don't know. I think you and I have kind of dominated the world here so long. I'm going to just shut up and sit back for a minute.
So, okay. So let's talk about what you guys do first off.
Well, I'm Tom Charpentier, Government Relations Director here at EAA. So I do a lot of regulatory policy stuff. I also do aeromedical counseling for members. So, pretty much anything that has to do with regulation and policy, comes across all of our desks, and I pitch in on that. And Lily?
Yeah, I'm Government Advocacy Specialist for EAA, so I am kind of the staff lead for UAS issues. I represent our team on the FAA Unmanned Aircraft Safety Team, and that
wow, kind of yeah.
stuff.
So you guys are sitting at the big table with how many other members are a part of that council?
Yeah, I think there's 60 or 70 other members, manufacturers, other manned organizations, all sorts of groups, and the FAA and NTSB as well.
Yep, that goes back to that camps group we were talking about, mm-hmm. where there's many different interests all sitting at the same table, and they're all vying for the biggest power. So
it's a very eclectic group. I've been involved with GA safety groups, where it's, the General Aviation Manufacturers Association, NBAA, all those other associations, and then you go to over to UAST, and it's like CNN and Amazon.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, and that raises another good point of another constituency is these end users, we'll call it. Mm-hmm. That Amazon, probably the most obvious of, hey, we could do a major thing, but it would be so much in the air that their use case is going to drive some of the policies that's out there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, Sean very clearly articulated kind of our position here is, EAA has always been primarily focused on representing recreational aviation, mostly human piloted aviation. But of course, we do see the UAS community as a major pathway into that. I think you referenced, I think that was an article I wrote for the magazine on the issue of the relative risk of us up there. And let's just go back to maybe a UAS operator kind of misbehaving and, flying up into airspace they shouldn't, and we swap paint up there.
Yep.
Well, if I'm in, our flying club's RV6, it's my life on the line up there,
exactly.
Not necessarily the UAS mm-hmm. operator.
Yep.
But it's my lithium battery you just ruined.
Exactly. And no matter where, if it fell off of from 5,000 feet, where's that going? But
this is a great segue into this issue of enforcement. We're talking about rules, and the rules right now are changing so fast that no law enforcement ever gets it correct anymore anyway. Because, I feel for them. Rules are changing faster than they can learn about them. But at the end of the day, none of this makes any difference if there isn't some form of enforcement on that. And what is the kind of position that EAA takes on how rules about UAS use should be enforced or could be enforced?
Well, enforcement is a sticky pathway or wicket, right?
Mm-hmm.
Our biggest concern is while the various agencies that perhaps could get involved with enforcement, local law enforcement, state highway patrol, etc., like you described, oftentimes they don't have enough knowledge or it's not a high enough priority for them to really put resources involved. For our membership, though, the real concern is anybody who holds a pilot certificate. Because if you go out and violate a UAS rule or policy requirement, if I go out to the model field and I go to 450 feet right now in Class G airspace, and somehow somebody makes an issue, and it could be just somebody who at the club who doesn't like me and calls the local Milwaukee FISDO and files the complaint. And if they are able to show, particularly if tracking ID becomes a reality mm-hmm. for all model aircraft, the first thing that they're going to go enforce against is my pilot certificate.
Yeah.
That's just a fact, because that's their mechanism. That's their easy lever to go do something about a violation.
Now, what about if we're talking, I am a 13-year-old and I just got my first drone, and the first thought I had was go fly it over an airplane or an airport because I like it. I like the idea. I want to get cool pictures. Now, there's where our enforcement starts to break down. Yeah. And we have, and that the problem is those incidents are the incidents that end up changing policy for the people who do follow the rules.
Yeah, it's the bad actors, the few bad actors that create the that perception of safety problems.
No question.
You know, and that was true of manned flight. Yep. You know, forever. It was the people that were out there doing, frankly, dumb things that was making everybody else look bad.
Yep.
And that's continuing to drive policy.
And Lily, on the UAST, you're involved with a sightings working group, right? That's kind of trying to standardize that?
Yeah, we had a working group that came together to work on reporting for pilots, for manned pilots to actually report drone sightings and the format for that. So kind of the information that I guess you would give to an air traffic controller if you saw a drone in the air.
Oh, very cool. So that kind of increases your eyes and ears instead of having to rely on one or two. Your all of general aviation could be helping out.
I mean, to me, the big thing that has to happen within the community of UAS folks is self-policing.
Yeah.
You know, we've got to be empowered, almost like Mothers Against Drunk Driving.
Yeah.
Because all it takes is one bad action to create a rule change or a policy change that affects thousands of good people, right? So, you know, the person that decides it's a good idea to run a quadcopter on final approach to, you know, McCarran Airport in Las Vegas really, really needs somebody else to intervene and say, don't do that. What are you thinking?
Mm-hmm.
Knock it off.
And I think the drone community as a whole has been pretty good at that. The frustration has always been is, yeah, we can publicly shame them, but that's about the end of it.
There have been some civil enforcement penalties that have been, enacted from the FAA through folks that, you know, have been caught. But tracking ID, obviously, is going to open up a whole other realm of the ability for people to get tracked down as being part of the bad behavior or inappropriate action. So we'll see how that plays out. But in the meantime, it really it's like I said, Mothers Against Drunk Driving or REA membership. REA membership is really good at the local airports about going out and saying, yo, you are doing stupid pilot tricks that eventually is going to either hurt yourself or, more importantly, hurt somebody I care about. And you need to stop doing that.
Exactly. Now, let's go back to track and ID. We keep hearing that come up. I'd like you to talk a little bit more about that and what it entails. And also, is this an equipment thing or is this a software thing? And just go ahead and speak on it a little bit.
Sure. I mean, I don't know all the specific nuts and bolts of it. I know the basic premise of when it's enacted as a new policy through the FAA, it will require U.S. equipment that are not operating, hopefully, and this is still being determined. Equipment that are not being operated at a charted site, it will require that equipment to have the ability to telemetry their position and the operator information in a way that's trackable.
Yeah.
I believe DJI was working on a software solution where the controller knows where the drone's at.
Mm-hmm.
And the controller is typically connected to something that has network, so
right.
You can relay that information. It was a software solution that didn't have a lot of extra cost to it.
And that's the big key. You need the backwards compatibility to older units that are currently flying now. Otherwise, 50% of your fleet's untrackable.
Yeah, that and just the sheer cost of if I'm a traditional legacy modeler and I'm running Spectrum equipment, let's say, and, you know, I've got my, you know, six-channel receivers that I've been using forever and a SIG Señorita.
Yep.
And now I've got to go out and get a whole new radio, a whole new set of receivers, and have this additional capability at the same club field I've been flying at for the last 30 years. That's what will, if that happens, that'll be a real crying shame for the model aviation community.
This strangely has a parallel back to the ADS-B before it was requirement. It's almost the exact same thing.
You know, it is, but at least the rule requirement for ADS-B is almost identical to transponder requirements. So if you're in an area that does not require a transponder on board the aircraft, it's the same thing. So we've effectively protected the J3 Cub. Or the Piper that's flying out of Wapaka, nothing changes for them. Only if you need access to Class C rural airspace, right? Class C or Class B or above 10,000 feet. Otherwise, you don't need it. So I think that was the better way to move ahead with the ADS-B aspect.
Yep. And as airspace has become more complex, I mean, you bring up transponders that have been around for a long time. But I remember when Mode C, that the controversy of adding the Mode C requirement and then the Mode S requirement and now ADS-B requirement and now adding, you know, because we're trying to pack the skies with more stuff.
Yeah, and in this case, they're trying to make the system more efficient too, which we also argued, look, the problem is the concrete. It's that when we're arguing against privatization. It's not the lack of efficiency of the NAS. It's the space available in the concrete or weather that, that primarily causes ATC delays.
Well, let's end this on a decidedly up note, at least for me personally. On field at Oshkosh Air Venture, we can go fly our drones.
Yes, we can.
Tell me about that.
It was many years ago. I'm trying to remember back the exact date or year, but it was 2012 or 2013.
Yeah, 13 or 14.
13, Tom? Yeah. Thank you. So I put together the basic parameters and worked with AMA as a partner organization to basically have an RC model field on site and have it right in the heart of the world's busiest airspace for the entire week of AirVenture. We did it in a very special way that put it right in a spot that was pretty much sterile as far as any arrivals or departures, with a few exceptions. And we put it at a time of the day that really made sense. It's the evening, which is the best time to fly, right? It's 7 p.m. at night to 9:30. AMA, Mark Radcliffe from AMA is the safety coordinator and an officer on the site. And absolutely, he's there every night. We all pop in to see how things are going. And model aircraft folks are able to operate, and so are quadcopters, up to 400 feet right over the southeast side of the Pioneer Airport runway with models. And it's actually, we actually built language into the waiver this year that allowed us to absolutely continue to do that. So we've got good coordination with air traffic, and it's a real hit. Our members love it.
Oh, yeah. And going back to that self-policing thing, so I flew a mission up there. I did a 360 panoramic with one of my drones, and I posted that online, and I got flamed. You can't fly drones. Like, no, really, you can't.
Show them a picture of the sign.
Right? Yeah, but a lot of people didn't know about that. So by all means, if you've got the wherewithal, and I think it does require AMA membership.
It does require AMA membership from insurance aspects.
Sure.
And as we finish up our 1 week build of the second E-Cadet, which is a new program between chapters and AMA clubs, we're going to do its first flight at the end of the week there as well.
Nice. I've always said next year, when you guys are going to try and probably do a 1 week wonder over there, I'm going to do the 1 hour wonder of a flight test plane here. We're going to do it on air. All right.
Nice.
All right. Hey, thanks so much for joining us. This has been very educational, and thanks to EAA for embracing the UAV industry as a whole and advocating for members from both sides of that aisle.
Well, thank you for having us tonight, gang. We're happy to be doing what we do for the organization and for our 220,000 members.
Thanks.
All right. This is the Drone Zone with EAA Radio.